rested not only on Carmela, but also on me, like a demanding ghost. If I had had to make a decision in the pure disorder of emotions in a situation like that, what would I have done? I would have run away. And if I had been with Leela, I would have pulled her by the arm. I would have whispered, "Let's go." And then, as usual, I would have stayed, because she, as usual, would have decided to stay. Instead, in her absence, after a slight hesitation, I put myself in her place. Or rather, I had made a place for her in me. If I thought again of the moment when Gino made his request, I felt precisely how I had driven myself away, how I had mimicked Leela's look and tone and behavior in situations of brazen conflict, and I was pleased. But sometimes I wondered, somewhat anxiously, am I being like Carmela? I didn't think so. It seemed to me that I was different, but I couldn't explain in what sense, and my pleasure was spoiled. When I passed Fernando's shop with my ice cream and saw Leela intently arranging shoes on a long table, I was tempted to stop and tell her everything, hear what she thought. But she didn't see me, and I kept going. 4. She was always busy. That year, Reno compelled her to enroll in school again, but again she almost never went, and again she failed. Her mother asked her to help in the house. Her father asked her to be in the shop, and she, all of a sudden, instead of resisting, seemed, in fact, content to labor for both. The rare times we saw each other, on Sunday after Mass, or walking between the public gardens and the Stradone, she displayed no curiosity about my school, and immediately started talking intensely and with admiration about the work that her father and brother did. She knew that her father, as a boy, had wanted to be free, had fled the shop of her grandfather, who was also a shoemaker, and had gone to work in a shoe factory in Kazoria, where he had made shoes for everyone, even soldiers going to war. She had discovered that Fernando knew how to make a shoe from beginning to end by hand, but he was also completely at home with the machines and knew how to use them, the post machine, the trimmer, the sander. She talked to me about leather, uppers, leather goods dealers, leather production, high heels and flat heels, about preparing the thread, about soles, and how the sole was applied, colored and buffed. She used all those words of the trade as if they were magic, and her father had learned them in an enchanted world, Kazoria, the factory, from which he had returned like a satisfied explorer, so satisfied that he now preferred the family shop, the quiet bench, the hammer, the iron foot, the good smell of glue mixed with that of old shoes. And she drew me inside that vocabulary with such an energetic enthusiasm that her father and Reno, thanks to their ability to enclose people's feet in solid, comfortable shoes, seemed to me the best people in the neighborhood. Above all, I came home with the impression that, not spending my days in a shoemaker's shop, having for a father a banal porter instead, I was excluded from a rare privilege. I began to feel that my presence in class was pointless. For months and months it seemed to me that every promise had fled from the textbooks, all energy. Coming out of school, dazed by unhappiness, I passed Fernando's shop, only to see Leela at her workplace, sitting at a little table in the back, her thin chest with no hint of a bosom, her scrawny neck, her small face. I don't know what she did exactly, but she was there, active, beyond the glass door, set between the bent head of her father and the bent head of her brother. No books, no lessons, no homework. Sometimes I stopped to look at the boxes of polish in the window, The old shoes, newly resoled. New ones put on a form that expanded the leather and widened them, making them more comfortable. As if I were a customer and had an interest in the merchandise. I went away only, and reluctantly, when she saw me and waved to me. And I answered her wave, and she returned to concentrate on her work. But often it was Reno who noticed me first, and made funny faces to make me laugh. Embarrassed, I ran away without waiting for Leela to see me. One Sunday, I was surprised to find myself talking passionately about shoes with Carmela Peluso. She would buy the magazine Sogno and devour the photo novels. At first, it seemed to me a waste of time. Then I began to look, too. And we started to read them together and comment on the stories and what the character said, which was written in white letters on a black background. Carmela tended to pass without a break from comments on the fictional love stories to comments on the true story of her love for Alfonso. In order not to seem inferior, I once told her about the pharmacist's son, Gino, claiming that he loved me. She didn't believe it. The pharmacist's son was in her eyes a kind of unattainable prince, future heir of the pharmacy, a gentleman who would never marry the daughter of a porter. And I was on the point of telling her about the time he had asked to see my breasts and I had let him and earned 10 lire. But we were holding Sonia spread out on our knees, and my gaze fell on the beautiful high-heeled shoes of one of the actresses. This seemed to me a momentous subject, more than the story of my breasts, and I couldn't resist. I began to praise them and whoever had made such beautiful shoes, and to fantasize that if we wore shoes like that, neither Gino nor Alfonso would be able to resist us. The more I talked, though, the more I realized, to my embarrassment, that I was trying to make Leela's new passion my own. Carmela listened to me distractedly, then said she had to go. In shoes and shoemakers, she had little or no interest. Although she imitated Leela's habits, she, unlike me, held on to the only things that really absorbed her. The photo novels, love stories. 5. This entire period had a similar character. I soon had to admit that what I did by myself couldn't excite me. Only what Leela touched became important. If she withdrew, if her voice withdrew from things, the things got dirty, dusty. Middle school, Latin, the teachers, the books, the language of books seemed less evocative than the finish of a pair of shoes. And that depressed me. But one Sunday, everything changed again. We had gone, Carmela, Leela, and I, to catechism. We were preparing for our first communion. On the way out, Leela said she had something to do, and she left us. But I saw that she wasn't heading toward home. To my great surprise, she went into the elementary school building. I walked with Carmela, but when I got bored, I said goodbye, walked around the building, and went back. The school was closed on Sunday. How could Leela go into the building? After much hesitation, I ventured beyond the entranceway, into the hall. I had never gone into my old school, and I felt a strong emotion. I recognized the smell, which brought with it a sensation of comfort, a sense of myself that I no longer had. I went into the only door open on the ground floor. There was a large neon-lit room, whose walls were lined with shelves of old books. I counted a dozen adults, a lot of children. They would take down volumes, page through them, put them back, and choose one. Then they got in line in front of a desk, behind which sat an old enemy of Maestro Oliviero's, lean Maestro Ferraro, with his crew-cut gray hair. Ferraro examined the chosen text, marked something in the record book, and the person went out with one or more books. I looked around. Leela wasn't there. Maybe she had already left. What was she doing? She didn't go to school anymore. She loved shoes and old shoes. And yet, without saying anything to me, she came to this place to get books? Did she like this space? Why didn't she ask me to come with her? Why had she left me with Carmela? Why did she talk to me about how souls were ground and not about what she read? I was angry and ran away. For a while, school seemed to me more meaningless than ever. Then I was sucked back in by the press of homework and end-of-the-year tests. I was afraid of getting bad grades. I studied a lot, but aimlessly. And other preoccupations weighed on me. My mother said that I was indecent with those big breasts I had developed, and she took me to buy a bra. She was more abrupt than usual. She seemed ashamed that I had a bosom, that I got my period. The crude instructions she gave me were rapid and insufficient, barely muttered. I didn't have time to ask her any questions before she turned her back and walked away with her lopsided gait. The bra made my chest even more noticeable. In the last months of school, I was besieged by boys, and I quickly realized why. Gino and his friend had spread the rumor that I would show how I was made easily, and every so often, someone would ask me to repeat the spectacle. I sneaked away. I compressed my bosom by holding my arms crossed over it. I felt mysteriously guilty and alone with my guilt. The boys persisted, even on the street, even in the courtyard. They laughed. They made fun of me. I tried to keep them off once or twice by acting like Leela, but it didn't work for me. And then I couldn't stand it and burst into tears. Out of fear that they would bother me, I stayed in the house. I studied hard. I went out now only to go, very reluctantly, to school. One morning in May, Gino ran after me and asked me, not arrogantly, but rather with some emotion, if I would be his girlfriend. I said no, out of resentment, revenge, embarrassment, yet proud that the son of the pharmacist wanted me. The next day he asked me again, and he didn't stop asking until June, when, with some delay due to the complicated lives of our parents, we made our first communion, the girls in white dresses, like brides. In those dresses, we lingered in the church square and immediately sinned by talking about love. Carmela couldn't believe that I had refused the son of the pharmacist, and she told Leela. She, surprisingly, instead of slipping away with the air of someone saying, "Who cares?" was interested. We all talked about it. "Why do you say no?" Leela asked me in dialect. I answered unexpectedly in proper Italian, to make an impression, to let her understand that even if I spent my time talking about boyfriends, I wanted to be treated like Carmela. Because I'm not sure of my feelings. It was a phrase I had learned from reading Sogno, and Leela seemed struck by it. As if it were one of those contests in elementary school, we began to speak in the language of comics and books, which reduced Carmela to pure and simple listener. Those moments lighted my heart and my head. She and I and all those well-crafted words. In middle school, nothing like that ever happened, not with classmates or with teachers. It was wonderful. Step by step, Leela convinced me that one achieves security in love only by subjecting the wooer to hard tests. And so, returning suddenly to dialect, she advised me to become Gino's girlfriend, but on the condition that all summer he agreed to buy ice cream for me, her, and Carmela. If he doesn't agree, it means it's not true love. I did as she told me, and Gino vanished. It wasn't true love then, and so I didn't suffer from it. The exchange with Leela had given me a pleasure so intense that I planned to devote myself to her totally, especially in summer, when I would have more free time. Meanwhile, I wanted that conversation to become the model for all our next encounters. I felt clever again, as if someone had hit me in the head, bringing to the surface images and words. But the sequel of that episode was not what I expected. Instead of consolidating and making exclusive the relationship between her and me, it attracted a lot of other girls. The conversation, the advice she had given me, its effect had so struck Carmela Peluso that she ended up telling everyone. The result was that the daughter of the shoemaker, who had no bosom and didn't get her period and didn't even have a boyfriend, became in a few days the most reliable dispenser on advice on affairs of the heart. And she, again surprising me, accepted that role. If she wasn't busy in the house or the shop, I saw her talking now with this girl, now with that. I passed by, I greeted her, but she was so absorbed that she didn't hear me. I always caught phrases that seemed to me beautiful, and they made me suffer. 6. These were desolate days, at the height of which came a humiliation that I should have predicted, and which instead I had pretended not to care about. Alfonso Caracci was promoted with an average of 8. Giliola Spagnuolo was promoted with an average of 7, and I had all 6s and 4 in Latin. I would have to take the exam again in September in that one subject. This time, it was my father who said it was pointless for me to continue. The school books had already cost a lot. The Latin dictionary, the Campanini and Carboni, even though it was bought used, had been a big expense. There was no money to send me to private lessons during the summer. But above all, it was now clear that I wasn't clever. The young son of Don Achille had passed, and I hadn't. The daughter of Spagnuolo, the pastry maker, had passed, and I hadn't. One had to be resigned. I wept night and day. I made myself ugly on purpose to punish myself. I was the oldest. After me, there were 2 boys and another girl, Elisa. Pepe and Gianni, the 2 boys, came in turn to console me, now bringing me some fruit, now asking me to play with them. But I felt alone just the same, with a cruel fate, and I couldn't calm down. Then one afternoon, I heard my mother come up behind me. She said in dialect, in her usual harsh tone, "We can't pay for the lessons, but you can try to study by yourself and see if you pass the exam." I looked at her uncertainly. She was the same, lusterless hair, wandering eye, large nose, heavy body. She added, "Nowhere is it written that you can't do it." That was all she said, or at least it's what I remember. Starting the next day, I began to study, forcing myself never to go to the courtyard or the public gardens. But one morning, I heard someone calling me from the street. It was Leela, who, since we finished elementary school, had completely gotten out of the habit. "Lenu," she called. I looked out. "I have to tell you something." "What?" "Come down." I went down reluctantly. It irritated me to admit to her that I had to take the exam again. We wandered a bit in the courtyard, in the sun. I asked unwillingly what was new on the subject of boyfriends. I remember that I asked her explicitly if there had been developments between Carmela and Alfonso. What sort of developments? She loves him. She narrowed her eyes. When she did that, turning serious, without a smile, as if leaving the pupils only a crack allowed her to see in a more concentrated way, she reminded me of birds of prey I had seen in films at the parish cinema. But that day it seemed to me she had perceived something that made her angry, and at the same time frightened her. "She didn't tell you anything about her father?" she asked. "That he's innocent. And who is the murderer?" "A creature half male and half female who hides in the sewers and comes out of the grates like the rats." "So it's true," she said, as if suddenly in pain. And she added that Carmela believed everything she said, that all the girls did. "I don't want to talk anymore. I don't want to talk anymore," she muttered, scowling. And I felt that she wasn't speaking with contempt, that the influence she had on us didn't please her, so that for a moment, I didn't understand. In her place, I would have been extremely proud. In her, though, there was no pride, but a kind of impatience mixed with the fear of responsibility. "But it's good to talk to other people," I murmured. "Yes, but only if when you talk, there's someone who answers." I felt a burst of joy in my heart. What request was there in that fine sentence? Was she saying that she wanted to talk only to me because I didn't accept everything that came out of her mouth but responded to it? Was she saying that only I knew how to follow the things that went through her mind? Yes. And she was saying it in a tone that I didn't recognize, that was feeble, although brusque as usual. She had suggested to Carmela, she told me, that in a novel or a film, the daughter of the murderer would fall in love with the son of the victim. It was a possibility. To become a true fact, a true love would have to arise. But Carmela hadn't understood, and right away, the next day, had gone around telling everyone that she was in love with Alfonso. A lie just to show off, whose consequences were unknown. We discussed it. We were 12 years old, but we walked along the hot streets of the neighborhood amid the dust and flies that the occasional old trucks stirred up as they passed, like two old ladies taking the measure of lives of disappointment, clinging tightly to each other. No one understood us, only we too, I thought, understood one another. We together, we alone, knew how the pall that had weighed on the neighborhood forever, that is, ever since we could remember, might lift at least a little if Peluso, the former carpenter, had not plunged the knife into Don Aquile's neck, if it was an inhabitant of the sewers who had done it, if the daughter of the murderer married the son of the victim. There was something unbearable in the things, in the people, in the buildings, in the streets, that, only if you reinvented it all, as in a game, became acceptable. The essential, however, was to know how to play, and she and I, only she and I, knew how to do it. She asked me at one point, without an obvious connection, but as if all our conversation could arrive only at that question. "Are we still friends?" "Yes." "Then will you do me a favor?" I would have done anything for her on that morning of reconciliation. Run away from home. Leave the neighborhood. Sleep in farmhouses. Feed on roots. Descend into the sewers through the grates. Never turn back. Not even if it was cold, not even if it rained. But what she asked seemed to mean nothing, and at the moment disappointed me. She wanted simply to meet once a day, in the public gardens, even just for an hour before dinner, and I was to bring the Latin books. "I won't bother you," she said. She knew already that I had to take the exam again and wanted to study with me. 7. In those middle school years, many things changed right before our eyes, but day by day, so that they didn't seem to be real changes. The Bar Solara expanded, became a well-stocked pastry shop, whose skilled pastry maker was Giliola Spagnuolo's father, which on Sunday was crowded with men, young and old, buying pastries for their families. The two sons of Silvio Solara, Marcello, who was around 20, and Michele, just a little younger, bought a blue and white Fiat 1100, and on Sundays paraded around the streets of the neighborhood. Peluso's former carpenter shop, which, once in the hands of Don Achille, had become a grocery, was filled with good things that spilled out onto the sidewalk, too. Passing by, you caught a whiff of spices, of olives, of salami, of fresh bread, of pork fat and cracklings that made you hungry. The death of Don Achille had slowly detached his threatening shadow from that place and from the whole family. The widow, Donna Maria, had grown very friendly, and now managed the store herself, along with Pinuccia, the 15-year-old daughter, and Stefano, who was no longer the wild boy who had tried to pierce Lila's tongue, but a self-possessed young man, his gaze charming, his smile gentle. The clientele had increased greatly. My mother sent me there to do the shopping, and my father wasn't opposed, partly because, when there was no money, Stefano wrote everything in a ledger book, and we paid at the end of the month. Assunta, who sold fruit and vegetables on the streets with her husband Nicola, had had to retire because of bad back pain, and a few months later, pneumonia almost killed her husband. Yet those two misfortunes had turned out to be a blessing. Now, going around the streets of the neighborhood every morning with the horse-drawn cart, summer and winter, rain and shine, was the oldest son, Enzo, who had almost nothing about him of the child who threw rocks at us. He had become a stocky youth, with a strong, healthy look, disheveled blonde hair, blue eyes, a thick voice with which he praised his wares. He had excellent products, and by his gestures alone, conveyed an honest, reassuring willingness to serve his customers. He handled the scale adroitly. I liked the speed with which he pushed the weight along the arm to find the right balance, the sound of iron scraping rapidly against iron, then wrapped the potatoes or the fruit and hurried to put the package in Signora Spagnuolo's basket, or Melina's, or my mother's. Initiatives flourished in the whole neighborhood. A young dressmaker became a partner in the dry goods store, where Carmela Peluso had just started working as a clerk, and the store expanded, aspiring to become a ladies' clothing shop. The auto repair shop, where Melina's son Antonio worked, was trying, thanks to the son of the old owner, Gentile Goresio, to get into motorcycles. In other words, everything was quivering, arching upward as if to change its characteristics, not to be known by the accumulated hatreds, tensions, ugliness, but rather to show a new face. While Lila and I studied Latin in the public gardens, even the pure and simple space around us, the fountain, the shrubbery, a pothole on one side of the street, changed. There was a constant smell of pitch. The steamroller sputtered, advancing slowly over the steamy asphalt, as bare-chested or T-shirted workers paved the streets and the stradone. Even the colors changed. Pasquale, Carmela's older brother, was hired to cut down the brush near the railroad tracks. How much he cut! We heard the sound of annihilation for days. The trees groaned, They gave off a scent of fresh green wood. They cleaved the air. They struck the ground after a long rustling that seemed a sigh. And he and others sawed them, split them, pulled up roots that exhaled an odor of underground. The green brush vanished, and in its place appeared an area of flat yellow ground. Pasquale had found that job through a stroke of luck. Sometime earlier, a friend had told him that people had come to the Bar Solara looking for young men to do night work, cutting down trees in a piazza in the center of Naples. He, even though he didn't like Silvio Solara and his sons, he was in that bar because his father was ruined, had to support the family and had gone. He had returned, exhausted at dawn, his nostrils filled with the odor of living wood, of mangled leaves, and of the sea. Then one thing led to another, and he had been summoned again for that kind of work. And now he was on the construction site near the railroad, and we sometimes saw him climbing up the scaffolding of the new buildings that were rising floor by floor, or in a hat made of newspaper, in the sun, eating bread with sausage and greens during his lunch break. Lila got mad if I looked at Pasquale and was distracted. It was soon obvious, to my great amazement, that she already knew a lot of Latin. She knew the declensions, for example, and also the verbs. Hesitantly, I asked her how, and she, with that spiteful expression of a girl who has no time to waste, admitted that during my first year of middle school, she had taken a grammar out of the circulating library, the one managed by Maestro Ferraro, and had studied it out of curiosity. The library was a great resource for her. As we talked, she showed me proudly all the cards she had. Four. One her own, one in Reno's name, one for her father, and one for her mother. With each, she borrowed a book, so she could get four at once. She devoured them, and the following Sunday, she brought them back and took four more. I never asked her what books she had read and what books she was reading. There wasn't time. We had to study. She drilled me and was furious if I didn't have the answers. Once, she slapped me on the arm, hard, with her long, thin hands, and didn't apologize. Rather, she said that if I kept making mistakes, she would hit me again, and harder. She was enchanted by the Latin dictionary, so large, pages and pages, so heavy, she had never seen one. She constantly looked up words, not only the ones in the exercises, but any that occurred to her. She assigned homework in the tone she had learned from our teacher, Maestra Oliviero. She obliged me to translate 30 sentences a day, 20 from Latin to Italian, and 10 from Italian to Latin. She translated them, too, much more quickly than I did. At the end of the summer, when the exam was approaching, she said warily, having observed skeptically how I looked up words I didn't know in the dictionary, in the same order in which I found them in the sentence to be translated, fixed on the principal definitions, and only then made an effort to understand the meaning. Did the teacher tell you to do it like that? The teacher never said anything. She simply assigned the exercises. I came up with that method. She was silent for a moment. Then she said to me, "Read the whole sentence in Latin first, then see where the verb is. According to the person of the verb, you can tell what the subject is. Once you have the subject, you look for the complements. The object, if the verb is transitive, or if not, other complements. Try it like that." I tried. Suddenly, translating seemed easy. In September, I went to the exam. I did the written part without a mistake and answered all the questions in the oral part. "Who gave you lessons?" the teacher asked, frowning. "A friend. A university student?" I didn't know what that meant. I said yes. Leela was waiting for me outside, in the shade. When I came out, I hugged her. I told her that I had done really well and asked if we would study together the following year. Since it was she who had first proposed that we meet just to study, inviting her to continue seemed to me a good way of expressing my joy and gratitude. She detached herself with a gesture almost of annoyance. She said she just wanted to understand what that Latin was that those clever ones studied. And then, I've understood. That's enough. You don't like it? Yes, I'll get some books from the library. In Latin? Yes. But there's still a lot to study. You study for me, and if I have trouble, you'll help me. Now I have something to do with my brother. What? I'll show you later. 8. School began again, and right away I did well in all the subjects. I couldn't wait for Leela to ask me to help her in Latin or anything else, and so, I think, I studied not so much for school as for her. I became first in the class. Even in elementary school I hadn't done so well. That year, it seemed to me that I expanded like pizza dough. I became fuller in the chest, the thighs, the rear. One Sunday, when I was going to the gardens, where I was planning to meet Giliolo Spagnuolo, the Solara brothers approached me in the 1100. Marcello, the older, was at the wheel. Michele, the younger, was sitting next to him. They were both handsome, with glossy black hair, white teeth. But of the two, I liked Marcello better. He resembled Hector as he was depicted in the school copy of the Iliad. They followed me the whole way, I on the sidewalk, and they next to me, in the 1100.
Have you ever been in a car?
No.
Get in. We'll take you for a ride.
My father won't let me.
And we won't tell him. When do you get the chance to ride in a car like this?
Never, I thought. But meanwhile, I said no, and kept saying no all the way to the gardens, where the car accelerated and disappeared in a flash beyond the buildings that were under construction. I said no, because if my father found out that I had gone in that car, even though he was a good and loving man, even though he loved me very much, he would have beat me to death. While at the same time, my little brothers, Pepe and Gianni, young as they were, would feel obliged, now and in the future, to try to kill the Solara brothers. There were no written rules. Everyone knew that was how it was. The Solaras knew it too, since they had been polite and had merely invited me to get in. They were not, sometime later, with Ada, the oldest daughter of Melino Cappuccio, that is, the crazy widow who had caused the scandal when the Saratores moved. Ada was 14. On Sunday, in secret from her mother, she put on lipstick, and, with her long straight legs and breasts even larger than mine, she looked grown up and pretty. The Solara brothers made some vulgar remarks to her. Michele grabbed her by the arm, opened the car door, pulled her inside. They brought her back an hour later to the same place, and Otto was a little angry, but also laughing. But among those who saw her dragged into the car were some who reported it to Antonio, her older brother, who worked as a mechanic in Gorazio's shop. Antonio was a hard worker, disciplined, very shy. Obviously wounded by both the untimely death of his father and the unbalanced behavior of his mother. Without saying a single word to friends and relatives, he waited in front of the bar Solara for Marcello and Michele. And when the brothers showed up, he confronted them, punching and kicking without even a word of preamble. For a few minutes he managed pretty well,
But then the father, Solara, and one of the barmen came out. They beat Antonio bloody, and none of the passers-by, none of the customers, intervened to help him. We girls were divided on this episode. Giliola Spagnuolo and Carmela Peluso took the part of the Solaras, but only because they were handsome and had an 1100. I wavered. In the presence of my two friends, I favored the Solaras, and we competed for who loved them most, since in fact they were very handsome, and it was impossible not to imagine the impression we would make sitting next to one of them in the car. But I also felt that they had behaved badly with Ada, and that Antonio, even though he wasn't very good-looking, even though he wasn't muscular like the brothers, who went to the gym every day to lift weights, had been courageous in confronting them. So in the presence of Lila, who expressed without half measures that same position, I too expressed some reservations. Once, the discussion became so heated that Lila, maybe because she wasn't developed as we were, and didn't know the pleasure fear of having the Solata's gaze on her, became paler than usual, and said that if what happened to Ada had happened to her, to avoid trouble for her father and her brother Reno, she would take care of the two of them herself. "Because Marcello and Michele don't even look at you," said Giliolo Spagnuolo, and we thought that Lila would get angry. Instead, she said seriously, "It's better that way." She was as slender as ever, but tense in every fiber. I looked at her hands and marveled. In a short time, they had become like Reno's, like her father's, with the skin at the tips yellowish and thick. Even if no one forced her, and that wasn't her job in the shop, she had started to do small tasks. She prepared the thread, took out stitches, glued, even stitched. And now she handled Fernando's tools almost like her brother. That was why that year she never asked me anything about Latin. Eventually, she told me the plan she had in mind, a thing that had nothing to do with books. She was trying to persuade her father to make new shoes. But Fernando didn't want to hear about it. "Making shoes by hand," he told her, "is an art without a future. Today there are cars, and cars cost money, and the money is either in the bank or with the loan sharks, not in the pockets of the Cerullo family." Then she insisted. She filled him with sincere praise. "No one knows how to make shoes the way you do, Papa." Even if that was true, he responded, everything was made in factories now. And since he had worked in the factories, he knew very well what lousy stuff came out of them. But there was little to do about it. When people needed new shoes, they no longer went to the neighborhood shoemaker. They went to the stores in the center of town, on the Rettifilo. So even if you wanted to make the handcrafted product properly, you wouldn't sell it. You'd be throwing away money and labor. You'd ruin yourself. Lila wouldn't be convinced, and as usual, she had drawn Reno to her side. Her brother had first agreed with his father, irritated by the fact that she interfered in things to do with work, where it wasn't a matter of books, and he was the expert. Then, gradually, he had been captivated, and now he quarreled with Fernando nearly every day, repeating what she had put into his head. "Let's at least try it." "No." "Have you seen the car the Solaras have? Have you seen how well the Carracci's grocery is doing?" "I've seen that the dry goods store that wanted to be a dressmaker's gave it up. And I've seen that Gorezio, because of his son's stupidity, has bitten off more than he can chew with his motorcycles." "But the Solaras keep expanding." "Mind your own business and forget the Solaras." "Near the train tracks, a new neighborhood is being developed." "Who gives a damn?" "Papa, people are earning, and they want to spend." People spend on food because you have to eat every day. As for shoes, first of all, you don't eat them. And second, when they break, you fix them, and they can last 20 years. Our work right now is to repair shoes, and that's it.
I liked how that boy, who was always nice to me, but capable of a brutality that frightened even his father a little, always, in every circumstance, supported his sister. I envied Leela, that brother who was so solid, and sometimes I thought that the real difference between her and me was that I had only little brothers, and so no one with the power to encourage me and support me against my mother, freeing my mind. While Leela could count on Reno, who could defend her against anyone, whatever came into her mind. But really, I thought that Fernando was right and was on his side. In discussing it with Leela, I discovered that she thought so too. Once, she showed me the designs for shoes that she wanted to make with her brother, both men's and women's. They were beautiful designs, drawn on graph paper, rich in precisely colored details, as if she had had a chance to examine shoes like that close up in some world parallel to ours, and then had fixed them on paper. In reality, she had invented them in their entirety, and in every part, as she had done in elementary school when she drew princesses, so that, although they were normal shoes, they didn't resemble any that were seen in the neighborhood, or even those of the actresses in the photo novels. Do you like them? They're really elegant. Reno says they're difficult, but he knows how to make them. He swears he can. And your father? He certainly could do it. Then make them. Papa doesn't want to. Why? He said that as long as I'm playing, fine, but he and Reno can't waste time with me. What does that mean? It means that to actually do things takes time and money. She was on the point of showing me the figures she had put down, in secret from Reno, to understand how much it really would cost to make them. Then she stopped, folded up the pages she was holding, and told me it was pointless to waste time. Her father was right. But then, we ought to try anyway. Fernando will get mad. If you don't try, nothing ever changes. What had to change in her view was always the same thing. Poor, we had to become rich. Having nothing, we had to reach a point where we had everything. I tried to remind her of the old plan of writing novels like the author of Little Women. I was stuck there. It was important to me. I was learning Latin just for that, and deep inside I was convinced that she took so many books from Maestro Ferraro's circulating library only because, even though she wasn't going to school anymore, even though she was now obsessed with shoes, she still wanted to write a novel with me and make a lot of money. Instead, she shrugged in her careless way. She had changed her idea of Little Women. Now, she explained, to become truly rich, you need a business. So she thought of starting with a single pair of shoes, just to demonstrate to her father how beautiful and comfortable they were. Then, once Fernando was convinced, production would start. 2 pairs of shoes today, 4 tomorrow, 30 in a month, 400 in a year. So that, within a short time, they, she, her father, Reno, her mother, her other siblings, would set up a shoe factory with machines and at least 50 workers. The Cerullo Shoe Factory. A shoe factory? Yes. She spoke with great conviction, as she knew how to do, with sentences in Italian, that depicted before my eyes the factory sign, Cerullo. The brand name stamped on the uppers, Cerullo,
And then the Cerullo shoes, all splendid, all elegant, as in her drawings. Shoes that once you put them on, she said, are so beautiful and so comfortable that at night you go to sleep without taking them off. We laughed. We were having fun. Then Leela paused. She seemed to realize that we were playing, as we had with our dolls years earlier, with Tina and New in front of the cellar grating. And she said, with an urgency for concreteness, which emphasized the impression she gave off of being part child, part old woman, which was, it seemed to me, becoming her characteristic trait. You know why the Solara brothers think they're the masters of the neighborhood?
Because they're aggressive?
No, because they have money.
You think so?
Of course. Have you noticed that they've never bothered Pinuccia Karachi?
Yes.
And you know why they acted the way they did with Ada?
No.
Because Ada doesn't have a father. Her brother Antonio counts for nothing, and she helps Melina clean the stairs of the buildings.
As a result, either we, too, had to make money, more than the Solaras, or, to protect ourselves against the brothers, we had to do them serious harm.
She showed me a sharp shoemaker's knife that she had taken from her father's workshop. They won't touch me because I'm ugly, and I don't have my period, she said. But with you, they might. If anything happens, tell me.
I looked at her in confusion. We were almost 13. We knew nothing about institutions, laws, justice.
We repeated, and did so with conviction, what we had heard and seen around us since early childhood. Justice was not served by violence? Hadn't Signor Peluso killed Don Achille?
I went home. I realized that with those last words, she had admitted that I was important to her, and I was happy.
9. I passed the exams at the end of middle school with 8s, and a 9 in Italian, and a 9 in Latin. I was the best in the school, better than Alfonso, who had an average of 8, and much better than Gino. For days and days I enjoyed that absolute superiority. I was much praised by my father, who began to boast to everyone about his oldest daughter who had gotten 9 in Italian, and 9 no less in Latin. My mother, to my surprise, while she was in the kitchen washing vegetables, said to me, without turning, "You can wear my silver bracelet Sunday, but don't lose it." I had less success in the courtyard. There, only love and boyfriends counted. When I said to Carmela Peluso that I was the best in the school, she immediately started talking to me about the way Alfonso looked at her when he went by. Giliola Spagnuolo was bitter because she had to repeat the exams for Latin and mathematics and tried to regain prestige by saying that Gino was after her. But she was keeping him at a distance because she was in love with Marcello Solara, and maybe Marcello also loved her. Even Leela didn't show particular pleasure. When I listed my grades, subject by subject, she said, laughing in her malicious tone, "You didn't get 10? I was disappointed. "You only got 10 in behavior. The teachers never gave anyone a 10 in important subjects. But that sentence was enough to make a latent thought become suddenly open. If she had come to school with me, in the same class, if they had let her, she would have had all 10s. And this I had always known, and she also knew. And now she was making a point of it. I went home with the pain of being first, without really being first. Further, my parents began to talk about where they could find a place for me, now that I had a middle school diploma. My mother wanted to ask the stationer to take me as an assistant. In her view, clever as I was suited to selling pens, pencils, notebooks, and school books. My father imagined future dealings with his acquaintances at the city hall that would settle me in a prestigious post. I felt a sadness inside that, although it wasn't defined, grew and grew and grew to the point where I didn't even feel like going out on Sunday. I was no longer pleased with myself. Everything seemed tarnished. I looked in the mirror and didn't know what I would have liked to see. My blonde hair had turned brown. I had a broad, squashed nose. My whole body continued to expand, but without increasing in height. And my skin, too, was spoiled. On my forehead, my chin, and around my jaws, archipelagos of reddish swellings multiplied, then turned purple, finally developed yellowish tips. I began, by my own choice, to help my mother clean the house, to cook, to keep up with the mess that my brothers made, to take care of Elisa, my little sister. In my spare time, I didn't go out. I sat and read novels I got from the library. Grazia Deleda, Pirandello, Chekhov, Gogol, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky. Sometimes I felt a strong need to go and see Lila at the shop and talk to her about the characters I liked best, sentences I had learned by heart. But then I let it go. She would say something mean. She would start talking about the plans she was making with Reno. Shoes, shoe factory, money. And I would slowly feel that the novels I read were pointless, and that my life was bleak, along with the future and what I would become. A fat, pimply sales clerk in the stationery store across from the parish church. An old maid employee of the local government, sooner or later cross-eyed and lame. One Sunday, inspired by an invitation that had arrived in the mail in my name, in which Maestro Ferraro summoned me to the library that morning, I finally decided to react. I tried to make myself pretty, as it seemed to me I had been in childhood, as I wished to believe I still was. I spent some time squeezing the pimples, but my face was only more inflamed. I put on my mother's silver bracelet. I let down my hair. Still, I was dissatisfied. Depressed, I went out into the heat that lay on the neighborhood like a hand swollen with fever in that season, and made my way to the library. I immediately realized, from the small crowd of parents and elementary and middle school children flowing toward the main entrance, that something wasn't normal. I went in. There were rows of chairs already occupied, colored festoons, the priest, Maestro Ferraro, even the principal of the elementary school, and Maestra Oliviero. Ferraro, I discovered, had had the idea of awarding a book to the readers who, according to his records, had been most assiduous. Since the ceremony was about to begin and lending was suspended for the moment, I sat at the back of the room. I looked for Lila, but saw only Giliola Spagnuolo, with Gino and Alfonso. I moved restlessly in my chair, uneasy. After a while, Carmela Peluso and her brother Pasquale sat down next to me. Hi. Hi. I covered my blotchy cheeks better with my hair. The small ceremony began. The winners were, first, Raffaella Cerullo. Second, Fernando Cerullo. Third, Nunzia Cerullo. Fourth, Rino Cerullo. Fifth, Elena Greco. That is, me. I wanted to laugh, and so did Pasquale. We looked at each other, suffocating our laughter, while Carmela whispered insistently, "Why are you laughing?" We didn't answer. We looked at each other again and laughed with our hands over our mouths. Thus, still feeling that laughter in my eyes, and with an unexpected sense of well-being, after the teacher had asked repeatedly and in vain if anyone from the Cerullo family was in the room, He called me, fifth on the list, to receive my prize. Praising me generously, Ferraro gave me 3 men in a boat by Jerome K. Jerome.